I'll just bleep out this entire section.
The bit where I talk about Parks and Recreation.
No, the bit where you call Lil Sebastian not a major character. So, episode 50.
We're episode 50. Officially, episode, I'm celebrating.
Cheers. We're recording in the evening, not 11 in the morning. If anybody is concerned by Joanna's glass of bubbly, they shouldn't be. Oh, no more than usual.
The people on video who can see the glass of bubbly, the people wouldn't have known.
Yeah, but I like to tell on you, so... I mean, it's 6:45 and I'm still drinking coffee, having had many coffee this afternoon.
Between us, we're almost going to make one functioning podcast host.
That's the hope. This is our second attempt at recording today. We had some IT problems this afternoon, this morning when we were intending to try this. We did meet up for coffee on the balcony as planned, so we have had a socialising day, and it's not too...
We have. We've talked at each other a lot already today.
We have.
I can't believe we're at 50 episodes, though.
Yeah, and it's more than that, isn't it? Because
we've done a bunch of bonus episodes. So yeah. We're not counting there.
If I open my podcast player, it'll tell me how many, actually. But, yeah, it's genuinely insane to me that we've, recorded and released over 50 times now.
That's, over 100 hours.
Edited, recorded, released. I know. This is really, good for my eventual plan to, if I can't be uploaded to the cloud, at least become a possible AI.
Yeah, I feel like enough of our personalities could be reconstructed from this podcast.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. 60 altogether. We've done 10 excellent bonus episodes. That's a nice round number as well.
Ah, so happy 50th/60th episode.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our golden anniversary.
No, wait.
It's our golden or diamond. Golden's 50, right?
Golden Jubilee, yeah.
Yeah.
Which means we get to land on St. James's Field in a helicopter, I believe.
Excellent.
A helicopter.
Helicopter? I'm so easily excited. I need to get out more.
Yeah. How are you? How are you, Joanna?
I'm okay. It's very weird talking to each other and doing this when we have just spent 4 hours together.
It is. It was very nice though. We had an accidental bit of summer that we weren't expecting.
Yes, unexpected
somehow
summer.
Your balcony is such a sun trap that I can now see through the webcam that I have sunburnt my nose despite the sun cream you kind of gave me. I did not get in that quick enough. All right, so I didn't prepare a flag, but in the manner of a small child at a coronation, hooray. My god, I look so tired today.
You do not.
I do a little bit. I mean, I'm not insulting myself. I just, my eyes look sleepy. It might just be the angle.
I am quite tired only because it's later in the day than I normally do anything other than slumping around my kitchen cooking dinner.
Yeah.
Which I'm not going to do at all tonight. I'm going to drink a bottle of Prosecco while we record this and then eat my entire body weight in Chinese food. Cheers. Here's to us and our 50 episodes. God, I never stick with anything this long. This is ridiculous.
I know. I think it's just because we don't want to disappoint each other.
Yeah.
It's kind of a loving obligation thing, which seems to be pretty good for our motivation.
That was the only reason I managed to stick with yoga as long as I did this year.
Yeah, same. Sorry.
It's not because of you. I gave up. It's because of the searing nerve pain I've had for 3 weeks now.
In my defense, I stopped mainly because I moved a bunch of furniture around and now there's a desk. My old desk in the middle of where I used to do yoga, and I don't know where to put it. My house is very small.
Why don't you get rid of the desk?
How? Where?
Oh, yeah, good point.
The tip's been... You need to book an appointment at the tip still.
That's why I still have a deconstructed sofa in my sewing room.
Yeah. That's just procrastination as well, that for me. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also just quite lazy. Should we make a podcast?
Yeah, let's make a podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is part two of our discussion of Men at Arms. The men and the women.
They are at arms.
As are the dwarves and trolls. And
The beings are at arms.
The beings, the ones that have arms. The dogs probably aren't because they've only got legs.
Yes. Well, I'm glad we've dissected that to death. Let's say something useful.
Note on spoilers before we get started. We are a spoiler light podcast, obviously heavy spoilers for Men at Arms, the book we're on. But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series, and we're saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
In forgotten tunnels underneath the city.
Ooh, tunnels.
Tunnels.
Do we have anything to follow up on?
Yes. Last week I said that I was going to look up the ridiculous aristocratic names. So there's a little list in Schott's Miscellany, which I've stolen from Jack. Some of the famous ones include like what looks like St. John is pronounced Sanjin or Sinjin here.
Sinjin?
Sinjin, yeah. Sinjin. Look, I'm looking at it and I still can't do it. probably the most impressively poshed is something that is spelt Featherstone Hoare. So Featherstone, H-A-U-G-H, all one word, and pronounced Fanshawe.
Excellent. God, yeah. I love the English language.
I know. Majori Banks, pronounced Marchbanks. Belvoir, pronounced Beaver for some reason, like that's better.
have you met the Beavers? Yes, they're good friends with the Featherstone Hoares.
And finally, Wolfhard is Worthy, which is Woolsey.
I really feel like the English should have our language confiscated.
Yes. I'll try and find a similar list to link online. Probably can't take a picture of this and post it. That sounds illegal.
Yeah, that's probably piracy. We should avoid that.
Be arrested.
We don't want you arrested. Pigeon. I'd download a pigeon. Fuck you.
I don't even remember the context from that.
I think it was a Tumblr post.
I'm just saying nonsense, remembering that I found it funny and finding it funny again. Excellent.
Quality content. Francine, would you like to tell us what happened previously on Men at Arms?
Certainly. I've got that written down already.
Excellent.
The Night Watch is filling its ranks with a new body of beings. The fresh meat and silicon-based life form faces a fractious introduction to Ankh-Morpork, dealing with interspecies turmoil and discovering two murder victims. Meanwhile, in the much higher echelons of Ankh-Morporkian society, temporarily embarrassed aristocrat Edward Deeth, Death? What did we
decide?
Deeth, thank you. Plots to restore the monarchy while his fellow blue-blooded bastards listen politely. Bridging the considerable gap between the two worlds is Sam Vimes, a common captain who's marrying rich, very rich. His soon-to-be spouse, Lady Sybil Rampkin, dragon doter and legend about town, chivvies him into smart clothes and idiot conversation, while tyrant Vetinari tells him to cease investigations. We leave our hero as he steadfastly ignores all instruction and follows his recruits to a crime scene.
Dun-dun-dun.
Dun-dun-dun.
I've attempted to summarise this section, but...
a lot happens.
So much happens, and I'm trying to at least keep these summaries to a single page.
Yeah.
So, just after breakfast, as Colon reads a thoroughly punctuated note from Carrot, a couple of members of the Fool's Guild arrive to collect Paul Beano's corpse. He delegates, sending Cuddy and Detritus to the Alchemist Guild to investigate some mysterious writing. Cuddy and Detritus proceed to the guild with its exploding balls and learn that they're in possession of Leonard de Quirm's recipe for number one firework powder, and that the mysteriously disappeared Dabbler had a tendency to write backwards. Colin and Nobbs head to the Fool's Guild just in time for Beano's funeral. They learn that Beano wasn't himself before he died, and neither was his nose, and they speculate on the rate of decomposition. Carrot takes Angua for breakfast at Gimlet's and a tour of the city. Vimes wakes to projectile attack and makes his way to the Opera House roof to track his assailant. A gargoyle witness informs him of a man with a fireworks stick. Carrot introduces Angua to the finest sights of Ankh-Morpork, if it's not its most colossal. They visit the Beggar's Guild just in time to investigate another murder. Lettuce Nibs, the Beggar Queen's maid, appears to have been hit with a projectile from the Opera House roof. Cuddy teaches Detritus to count. As Carrot and Angua head back to the watch house, Vimes hunts for some very black coffee and works out the shape of the Gon. Detritus defends Cuddy as they track a running assailant to the Port Futures warehouse. Vimes goes to Vetinari, who tells him to cease investigations again, and hand in his badge. Trapped in the Port Futures warehouse, Detritus throws Cuddy out of the window and the diminutive detective lands in Dibbler's new business venture. Detritus does some difficult maths before receiving rescue, and as Vimes drowns his sorrows, our dynamic duo find themselves down Quarry Lane. Dwarfs and trolls march, the Captain Quirk and the Daywatch have arrested Coalface the Troll, and Cuddy and Detritus find themselves down a deep hole. Carrot and Anger attempt to enforce some sobriety as they feed Vimes a Clatchian coffee. Cuddy and Detritus make an underground discovery and plan to dig their way back to the surface. Vimes breaks down as Quirk stands down the night watch. Trouble brews in the streets as Vimes heads home for a bath. Cuddy and Detritus dig their way out through the university library and take Carrot to claim the corpse they found, another dead Beano. The remaining watch speculate on Kings as an irreparable breakdown of law and order takes place, and Carrot forms a militia to defend streets.
That was a pretty concise summary, considering what I was expecting.
Yeah, I still managed to squeeze some alliteration and terrible puns in there, which that was what we really wanted, wasn't it?
Every time.
So, helicopter and loincloth watch.
Yes, go on, Joanna.
Helicopter!
Yes, loudly.
Sorry, I should probably... tried helicopter in the audio test before my usual bursar. There is a helicopter reference, or a spinning up into the air machine, as Leonard calls it. Yay. On page 196 of the Corky paperback edition.
If you want to go and see it yourself, listeners.
I am finally vindicated.
Finally the payoff. 50 episodes.
And we finally
bloody
got...
episodes.
And we finally got a helicopter. Which I think one cropping up in any way even once is still alarming regularity for a fantasy series. So,
alarming enough to perhaps make a bit.
I'm keeping
a
bit.
Okay.
It's my bit and I'm keeping it.
Fine, carry on.
Obviously, loincloths is always heavily implied. And for other bits, we're keeping track of the librarian is present, but not explained, although we do get a bit of primer on his methods of communication. Anyway, on to quotes.
Yes, I think yours is first.
I believe it is. So page 142. On a dais on the opposite side of the quadrangle was a fat clown in baggy trousers, huge braces, a bow tie that was spinning gently in the breeze, and a top hat. His face had been painted into a picture of misery. He held a bladder on a stick. The clown with the urn reached the dais, climbed the steps, and waited. The band fell silent. The clown in the top hat hit the urn carrier about the head with the bladder once, twice, three times. The urn bearer stepped forward, waggled his wig, took the urn in one hand and the clown's belt in the other, and with great solemnity poured the ashes of the late brother Beano into the other clown's trousers. A sigh went up from the audience. The band struck up the clown anthem, the March of the Idiots, and the end of the trombone flew off and hit a clown on the back of the head. He turned and swung a punch at the clown behind him, who ducked, causing a third clown to be knocked through the brass drum. Colin and Nobby looked at one another and shook their heads. Boffo produced a large red and white handkerchief and blew his nose with humorous honking sound. Classic, he said. It's what he would have wanted.
Total nonsense, Joanna. Well done.
It's not even my favourite quote from the bit. I just really wanted to see if I could read that whole bit out as deadpan as possible.
You did. Well done. I was very, very impressed. I think in my head I didn't manage to do it that deadpan, so you've made me laugh more than when I read it.
That's what I'm here for. What was your favourite quote?
My favourite quote was when Leonard Aquam is talking to Lord Vetinari about the possible mistake he's made in making this terrible, terrible weapon. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think we're looking at the helicopter.
We are.
We are. Lord Vetinari turned the model flying machine over and over in his fingers. "You dream of flying," he said. "Oh, yes, then men would be truly free. From the air, there are no boundaries. There could be no more war because the sky is endless. How happy we would be if we could but fly."
Well,
it's nice and naive and sweet and bittersweet. And I think there might be some parallel to it in real life, but I wasn't really sure where to start searching.
No, that's a difficult one. Oh, I mean, that brings us very nicely onto characters, because Leonard Quam is the first one I wanted to talk about.
Oh, okay. Well,
this is the
good one.
This is the most dangerous man in the world, as introduced last week.
Too smart by half.
Too smart by half. But he doesn't know he's a prisoner. He's constantly hit with inspiration particles, which we've been introduced to in earlier books. I think sorcery.
Sorcery and another one, at least, yeah.
Yeah, sorcery, I think, was the first time the concept was introduced. Because inspiration regularly hit
creosote.
But unfortunately, he had the poetic ability of a duck.
What a shame.
Tragic.
However, yes. Leonard Aquam has the inventing ability of a very good duck.
Yes.
Or indeed, not a duck at all. I don't know.
His naming ability, on
camel.
The other hand, leads.
The mathematical ability of a camel.
He is just as clever as you bastard. You bastard.
Bastard, but yes, not so great on the naming.
Not great.
Everybody has their flaws.
Yes, and his is mostly naming. I'm sure he's got a few other flaws as well.
Not making murder weapons.
Well, yeah, there is that. That's not really what I look for in a man.
I'd forgive it in this one.
But yes, it's exciting to meet him. He's a really nice character. Yeah. He's only got a little bit here, but it's nice to have a foil for Vetinari.
It is. For anyone not aware, he's quite obviously modelled on Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah.
It was the Renaissance. It's Renaissance. I'm using it right, aren't I? The great Renaissance mind.
Yes.
Artist, inventor, mirror writer.
Extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire. Yeah.
To the point where there's also a reference to de Quern's portrait of the Mona Og.
Yes.
Apparently the teeth followed you around the room. It's nice that Nanny's family is spread so wide, really.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they would, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I also quite like
that inclined.
In the introduction to Leonard, he's managed to invent post-its.
Yes, quite gruesome sounding ones.
Handy note scribbling piece of paper with glue that comes unstuck when you want. Which is not how I'm going to refer to post-its from now on, because I talk about them quite a lot with all of the ones I have. And
yes, that take too long. Thank you for not sticking with that bit.
I just don't have time in my day, Francine. I'm a very busy woman.
And then we meet Silverfish again.
Yes,
we just met him before in the moving pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They made the film. Yes, he was the first one to sort of invent the film. And it was just, I just wanted to point out, he's gone back to the Alchemist Guild and he's having fun. So I'm quite pleased for him.
One might say.
Possibly too much fun.
Although
we'll get on.
It's not the Alchemist's fault.
No, it's not entirely the Alchemist's fault. I will get on to the exploding
balls. Except they didn't train up Leonard by the sounds of it.
Well, he sort of absorbed knowledge from everywhere. It's described as having absorbed a rag bag amount of knowledge from the schools his parents sent him to.
Yes.
And we meet Dr. Whiteface as well, who is very creepy.
From the Fool's Guild,
Head of Fool's Guild. The one who never gets in the way of the custard. It's part of a longer description, but I very much just like that sentence because there's something...
That's a hell of an epitaph.
There's something so ominous about his description, but then you stop and look at it objectively, and custard is never not a funny word.
No.
I do enjoy the word custard. But yes, I like meeting Dr. Whiteface. I like that all of the guilds are, not all of them, but we're generally getting more flesh to them and meeting the leaders. Yeah, because most of what we've learned of the Fool's Guild so far is based on the Fool, or King Verence, as he's now known.
Yeah.
And hearing about his very depressing upbringing and how he'd hear the sounds of the assassins at play next door.
Yeah, and he's kind of stuck with this theme of the Fools. Most of them don't seem to much like it. Beano was quite... pleased to go into an afterlife without tomfoolery.
Yeah. Yes. I love the word tomfoolery.
Yes.
And then we meet Ornis Ogarooking Ordway.
Yes. Cornice overlooking Broadway. I'll be the grand leader.
I like this bit in general. So this is the gargoyle that Vimes chats to.
Yeah.
And they're explained as an urban troll species that had involved a symbiotic relationship with gutters.
Gargoyles have some interesting folklore behind them, don't they? I haven't looked into it for this.
We've
got quite enough to talk about anyway. But
that was one I put a pin in to maybe have a look at for next week. But I like the way they're depicted here as these sort of mini trolls that have picked up this symbiotic relationship with buildings.
Yeah.
And I like trying to, because their mouths are stuck open, trying to understand how they speak. E oot is oot on a ed anget og irak.
Firework.
He let off a firework. But there's a footnote as well in the section where we're introduced to Cornus overlooking Broadway about the other strange species on the disc, such as Lanka suicide thrush, the shadowing lemma, which exists only in two dimensions and eats mathematicians.
Terrible.
And the strangest and possibly the saddest speech from the disc world, the hermit elephant.
That's very sad.
Which doesn't have a thick hide, so it lives in huts and builds extensions as it grows. Occasionally,
little fella.
moves around in an entire village. Have you gotten a...
Yeah, I do.
Excellent.
A elephant fact from Shots Miscellany as well. I wouldn't have had one except I just accidentally happened upon it.
Excellent.
There's a list in Shots Miscellany of the curious deaths of some of the Burmese kings. Mm. And of the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 listed here, 3 of them were killed by an elephant. Uzana was trampled to death by an elephant in 1254. I don't know why I started this. I cannot pronounce this. Minreki Aswa, crushed to death by his own elephant in 1417, so he's not around to correct me. and Razadarit died after becoming entangled in the rope with which he was lassoing elephants in 1423. Oh, another one, 4. Tavin Shweti beheaded by his chamberlains while searching for a fictitious white elephant. So that was an elephant-adjacent death, but I think it still counts.
I'm still saying 4 deaths by elephant in the Burmese royalty. I'm starting to think this might not be a coincidence.
Me too. Yes, absolutely. That is my irrelevant fact. An interesting amount of Burmese kings died at the trunks of elephants.
Or the ropes of fictional elephants.
Yes.
Who else do we meet? We've got Queen Molly of the Beggars Guild.
Yes.
I like the way she has her little nod with Angua as the two working women to each other. The Beggars Guild being an equal opportunity non-employer. We did meet Queen Molly earlier in Guards.
Yes.
And who else? We've got Sham Haga, who we've met before, employer of death in the past.
Oh, I knew we'd seen him before. I couldn't remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Back in Malt.
I like Sham.
Mm.
Good lad. Knows how to make a terrible breakfast. What more can you want?
That's what I look for. Lots of people were trying to work out if there were any references to the nature of Sam's cooking or the menu in the dwarf restaurant. And it is that it seemed to be a lot of American listeners asking on Pratchett forums, and Terry Pratchett eventually responding with, it's just what shitty cafe menus are like in England.
Yeah, what were they trying to find references to, sorry?
If there was like a specific reference in the dodgy food at Shamhagas sauce rat and chips, and it's like, no, it's just...
That's just what breakfast menus look like in some cafes, yeah.
Yep.
Without rat, usually, like it'll be...
You say without rat. Yeah, egg and chips, sauce, egg and chips, double sauce, egg and chips. Oh, I really want chips now.
Yeah, me too. What the hell?
I'm sorry. I did have a very nutritious snack of potato smiley faces before we started recording.
Oh, yum, yum, yum.
Because I am a grown adult.
Yes. Oh my God, they're doing corn turkey dinosaurs now.
Oh my God. I'm really happy for you.
Yeah, thank you. Me too. It's an exciting day.
Oh, we're so mature. Sorry, where are we? Mayonnaise quirk.
Yeah. Was it thick, oily, and slightly eggy?
Yes. Thick, oily, smells faintly of eggs. I want to say I've got probably about 60 notes in this section, but I'm going to say at least 15% of those are just me taking notes of times I wanted to punch Captain Quirk, which, considering he's only really in one scene, is...
Yeah, so listeners, just assume that Joanna wants to punch Captain Quirk at all times and proceed accordingly.
Quite badly, yeah. It's some of the ways he's described is excellent, such as glancing around at the scenery as if he was doing it a favour.
I have to wonder if Pratchett's basing it off one person in particular and whether that one person ever felt called out.
I think you and I have both met multiple men like this, though.
This is true, yeah.
He wasn't actually a bad man. He didn't have the imagination. He dealt more in that sort of generalised low-grade unpleasantness which slightly tarnishes the soul of all who come into contact with it.
Yeah.
But this is a particular kind of white, greasy pub bore.
Yeah.
Who should not
be... One of the ones who goes, like, drunk with power in middle management.
Yeah, yeah. I think I have worked for this dude.
Yeah. Did you punch
Probably
him?
Probably. No, I try not to punch people when I work with them.
All right, that seems sensible.
Also, I'm really bad at punching.
I've never had to punch anybody. I know we've talked about this on the podcast before, bizarrely. I was all right at it when I did kickboxing briefly. the important thing is to get your thumb on top of your fingers, not within not your underneath. Fist. Yeah. You'll break your thumb.
So, yes. I rarely.
Top tip from you.
Top tip
from your friendly podcast neighborhood podcast.
Just in case any of our
when punching low grade racists, don't break your thumb.
Punching racists, yes. Breaking your thumb, no.
Oh, massive shout out to who was
Melissa?
It? Melissa, who made us a
great little cake. Yes, little... eugenics, no artwork.
Yeah, I did notice someone said something about merch, and I'm very sorry, but I refuse to have any merch with the word eugenics on it, even if it's eugenics. No, I'm just nixing that straight off. I'm very sorry.
I very much love the
I loved that I picture though.
We probably shouldn't sell merch with the word eugenics on it.
Yeah, I just know. I've already said the word eugenics too many times. If somebody wanted to take this out of context, they could.
Anyway, who else we meet? We meet Willikins. We met Willikins earlier, but I don't think we've actually mentioned him yet, which is...
Last name, sir.
What do people call you when they've got to know you better? Willikins, sir. At the moment, he's simply a very, very good butler to Sam. Yes,
of the Jeeves variety.
He's definitely got some Jeeves vibes.
Ooh, I fancy watching some Jeeves and Worcester.
Ooh, I haven't watched that for ages.
Yeah.
Excellent. And then you wanted to talk about Vimes a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah, just a very brief one. It feels odd not to mention it, and I was feeling more ready for that earlier. I forgot about it. but yeah, no, just a bit. It is an interesting thing to reread this now that I don't drink anymore, and reading the description of him falling off the wagon is a little bit of a gut punch these days, and I haven't read it since I stopped drinking. And so I just wanted to note that it's written very well, not in kind of mawkish graphic detail, but still with enough to kind of put the point across.
Yeah, it's realistic without being what's the word?
Triggering, honestly.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but yeah, it's not like glorying in the grit of it. Kind of.
It's not exploitative, it's not quite the right word.
Yeah,
but...
no, I know what word you're going for, and I can't think of it either. Anyway, so there's that.
Well done.
And yeah, I thought his breakdown in general was pretty good as well. Fuck it. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, here. Fuck it. This is all nonsense. Your words are nonsense. Nothing's going to change. It's rotten all the way down. And he's quite right, of course, but no.
I found that bit
light
really...
Light a candle in the darkness. What good is that going to do? That's just words.
I found that bit really relatable with how I've ended up feeling about politics over the last few years. Yeah. I've gone from incredibly enthused about politics to, oh, fucking God, what's the point? Nothing's going to change.
Yeah. And I did enjoy Carrot being called out a little bit on that, even though, like, obviously, I suppose the moral of the story isn't just to give up on everything. But the colon did it as well, just like, just being a bit more realistic is helpful for him, I think. So later on, it's like Carrot saying, we're armed with the truth. What can harm us if we're armed with the truth? Sergeant Colon says, well, a crossbow bolt can, e.g., go right through your eye and out the back of your head. Just like the cliche stuff needs to be.
Carrot's lovely optimism. Yeah, Carrot's lovely optimism works because there are people contrasting it and bringing him back down to earth.
Yes, and who don't just dismiss him as an idiot because he's personable and intelligent and that, but they do kind of go, well, we will need helmets.
Yeah. Crossbow bolts can still injure.
Yes.
Anyway,
crossbow bolt to the eye often offends.
Yes, I've heard that. So location.
The Alchemist Guild is still currently in the right place, which is nice.
Yes, it has not been exploded. The Gambler's Guild is across the road.
Despite the best efforts of its inhabitants, because I think, what did they say? They were using nitrate and camphor, and I'm pretty sure both of those things are just explosives.
Camphor to the nitrocellulose. So I looked this up. This is fun.
Oh, cool. Well done. Chemistry.
Fun facts chemistry about me. It's not really science. Fun chemistry facts,
fun
but specifically
fact.
The history of exploding balls.
Okay. Is this like the Todger thing again?
No, this is nothing like the Todger thing. This is... so what is it? They say they're using nitrocellulose and camphor.
Balls.
So billiard balls used to be made of ivory.
That's bad.
Very bad. But obviously a billiard ball or a pool ball or a snooker ball, it needs to have very specific properties. It's got to be exactly dense enough so it moves in the right way and they ricochet off each other. And ivory was considered the perfect material to the point where top grade ivory was actually called billiards ivory.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But there was a perceived shortage of ivory in the mid-19th century. And this is kind of how a lot of development into early plastics came about, because they were looking for something to replace ivory in billiard balls. Billiards was incredibly popular, especially in America in the mid-19th century.
Science is driven by the oddest things.
It really is, to the point where someone actually offered like a $10,000 reward, which in those days was a lot
billiards
of money.
Isn't that good?
Yeah, so I don't know if that's $10,000 in today's money or if it was $10,000 back then. I will link to a couple of articles about this in the show notes, though, because it's really fun.
Yeah.
So this is how early plastics development came about. And one of the first things that was used to make billiard balls instead of ivory was celluloid, which is made from nitrocellulose,
okay.
Which is explosive. So nitrocellulose is also known as flash paper or gun cotton. So you think they realize, probably not a good idea. But it was developed as a faux ivory. But yeah, flammable, explosive. When balls crashed into each other, they would quite often explode.
Oh, so
or at least let off very
small.
It's completely based in reality.
Excellent.
But yes, fun thing. Celluloid would then go on to be used for really early film in the early 20th century.
Also
not great. Also very flammable. But to tie us all back to Silverfish and moving pictures.
Yes.
Someone please take the nitrocellulose away from Mr. Silverfish.
Yes.
Yes, so that's my fun exploding balls fact. Oh, and billiard balls are now generally made of resin, which is less explodey and doesn't involve murdering elephants.
Thumbs up for resin. I see. Don't tell me it's problematic.
I'm pretty sure resin isn't problematic. Listeners, don't let us know. I don't care.
We're gonna look like monsters if it turns out it was behind a genocide.
Yes, genocidal resin. I mean, it's plastic, so like technically all plastic is bad because the oceans, but
I think that's a bullshit statement, actually.
Well, gentle reminder that the word oceans is quite problematic. As I talked about the Fool's Guild and the funeral and how much I enjoyed that, see how I'm just changing the subject now.
Okay. Good, because oh my god, okay, right, yes, sorry, Fool's Guild funeral.
Fool's Guild funeral.
Delicatessen.
Yeah, so we've heard of Gimlet's Delicatessen. Well, we've
heard
of Gimlet's
Delicatessen. Have you heard?
This isn't just Delicatessen.
Have you heard of rat with ketchup? 7p.
Cream cheese rat. It's possibly my least favorite combination of words in the English language. Cream cheese rat. But yeah, no, so we've heard of Gimlet, who runs the delicatessen, as in he had eyes like that dwarf that runs the delicatessen around the road. So it's quite nice to actually meet it for the first time, including the menu of things like sauce, egg, beans and rat, written in Ogham.
Yes.
Which we met in Lords and Ladies last week.
Yeah.
Grope Alley.
Yeah, just to mention, because that was a thing in the UK and in London, in fact, just a ruder version of, wasn't it?
Yes, it has since been renamed, but it was Grope C Word Lane.
The one word we won't say on the podcast.
Yes.
But yes, and it's now been renamed to Threadneedle Lane, which apparently is just as innuendo-y, but slightly more subtle.
That's where the Bank of England is.
They are a bunch of fuckers.
They are a bunch of grope C words.
Bunch of thread needles.
There's another grope.
Seamstress.
Ah, all ties back together. Excellent.
It ties with
that. That was the thing and the other
Oh
thing.
My god, it never ends.
You know what?
You end all the way down.
I think the bloke who wrote these books might actually be a bit clever, Francine.
It's all coincidence, if you ask me.
No such thing.
Pork futures.
I really like the idea of the
not
pork futures where innuendo, and this time I mean it. The pork futures warehouse.
Yes, you quite enjoy these ridiculous little forays into the temporal economy.
The temporal economy, which is part of the product of the patricians' rules about baseless metaphors, the literal mindedness of citizens who assumed everything must exist somewhere, and the general thinness of the fabric of reality around Ankh. So the trading of future pork as in pork that has not actually come into existence yet means there now has to be a warehouse for it to wait until it comes into existence.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's probably some current commentary on the stock market, which I don't understand because I don't want to learn about stonks.
Futures are things. Ridiculous. That's all you need to know about that.
I tried to understand it during the GameStop thing. I did
briefly. I'm sure I did. The economy is a bit like physics in that I understand it fine as I'm reading about it, and then very quickly the information drains away.
Anyway.
Free Jolly Luck takeaway fish bar.
No, hang on.
You have more to say on pork futures, do you? All right, carry on.
Well, so Pratchett's it's very cold. Pratchett's kind of realised that the trolls are smarter when it's colder, because that makes sense with how he set up trolls so far. And it makes sense with the Tolkien trolls where they turn to stone in daylight. Mm-hmm. He's obviously got to a point in the plot where he kind of needs to put detritus somewhere cold, and he needs to trap them somewhere because he needs to give detritus a clever moment, and which means he needs to create something like a walk-in freezer for them to be stuck in. And rather than going, I know this restaurant's got an ice house, he goes, let's invent the pork futures warehouse. And I think that there is some corkscrew logic there that leads to us having pork futures, and I greatly enjoy it.
Yes. Yeah, I wonder if kind of in his head he already had like pork futures somewhere, and there's just some kind of like mad cork board of string in there. And he's like, wait a minute, I can link these two.
Yes, these go together.
Finally put the pork futures in. My Discworld was built on pork futures. I've just been waiting.
Well, no, it's built on four elephants on the back of a turtle.
And then turtles all the way down. Quite right, quite right.
Three Jolly Luck takeaway fish bar.
Speaking of aquatic life.
This is just one of those things that becomes a running joke throughout the Discworld.
Yeah.
Because when something new comes, quite often it leads to dungeon dimensions, like obviously when film came to Ankh Morpork. Or might experience a bit more of what happens when thing happens.
Excellent description of the genre.
What happens when thing happens?
Otherwise known as speculative fiction, I believe.
Yeah, what happens when thing happens? That's what I said.
Right. Yeah, sorry. Just our accents are a bit different.
Yes, we've got such different
potato,
accents.
Potato, potato.
You say potato, I say three Jolly Luck takeaway fish bar on the site of the old temple in Dagon Street on the night of the winter solstice, when it also happens to be a full moon.
Let's call the whole thing off.
Anyway.
Sorry, please do tell me about the three Jolly Luck takeaway fish bar built on the site of...
On the site of the old temple in Dagon Street on the night of the winter solstice, when it also happens to be a full moon, Francine.
Yeah, sorry, tell me more about that. We've already seen this, haven't we?
This joke may have come up before, but this is the first time I think I've remembered to point out that this joke has come up. I like it, and it'll come up again.
Okay, cool.
That's the only reason I put it in. Fun little moment.
Because Dagon's some kind of fish god.
Dagon is some kind of fish god, also referenced in H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, that's it. That's what I'm thinking of, yeah. But Lovecraftian menace.
But it wasn't invented by Lovecraft. It is an older mythical creature.
I'm sure we've talked about this. I'm sure we have. It's not necessarily in recording, but yeah.
True. Apologies, listeners, if you've heard this bit before. And tunnels.
Yes, and tunnels, which we'll come to again later, but it's a fun enough location to mention in the list, I think.
Yes,
accidental tunnel exploration.
Mm.
Everyone loves the idea of underground tunnels under a city, don't they? In the town we live in, it's old enough that people speculate about old tunnels between the monastery and the town centre, and it's been proven or found, but it's just old enough with enough cellars that it's believable.
There are some old little underground works and things, but it's more to do with the fact that it's very chalky around here.
Yes. Chalk and flint, that's what we are.
Yes. Hence our trouble finding hagstones. Yeah, I think that's all the locations.
That is all the locations.
So, on to the little bits that we liked. Starting with Zorgo, the retrophrenologist.
Yeah, tell me about that, Joanna.
Well, so we sort of had a reference to phrenology in the last section when Vimes was kind of taking the piss out of the figures by saying, oh, notice how big or small their heads are.
Yes.
So for those not in the know, phrenology is a bullshit pseudoscience.
What? From...
a few centuries ago.
That sounds like something someone with a criminal skull would say.
It was based around defining personality from skull shape, and therefore you could prove who was criminal or a serial killer by the lift or fall of their brow. But phrenology was very much used racistly, unsurprisingly. Yes. Yeah. But I like the idea of Zorgo, the retrophrenologist, who has used the logical thinking that you could mould someone's character by changing the shape of their skull.
Sound logic.
In his case, using a hammer. I like to just, we're really into Pratchett using footnotes to the best of their ability. We haven't talked about footnotes for a while, actually.
No.
But I think as we're
just enjoyed them.
Yeah. As we're into mid-stage Discworld, he's really coming into his own with just using them to cram in a lot more funny bits per page.
Yeah, yeah.
And what he describes retrophrenology as, what you actually get is hit on the head with a selection of different sized mallets, but it creates employment and keeps the money in circulation, and that's the main thing.
That's the main thing. It's his little aside to the camera.
Yes, a little fourth wall break there. So yes, I like the idea of retrophrenology.
This won't hurt a bit, he said, quite honestly.
And then, yeah, we have the Beggar's Charter.
Mm.
And this is to do with the reason Lettuce Nibs is shot at is because she was trying on Molly's velvet gown.
Yeah.
And it appears that someone is trying to take out people in positions of power, potentially.
Yes.
With the gun. We'll get into the actual whodunit-ness a bit more, obviously, when we get into the final section next week.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I couldn't remember where I knew Some in Rags, Some in Tags, and One the Velvet Gown from, and it's from an old nursery rhyme. Hark, hark, the dogs do bark, beggars are coming to town, some in rags, some in tags, and one in a velvet gown.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't gone down, I could go down a massive rabbit hole about origins of nursery rhymes, and I probably will at some point.
Yeah, this doesn't seem like the one to go down no, that rabbit hole some, from.
There is some debate about it, it's quite interesting. So tags is sometimes written as jags. Some versions of it have some in velvet gowns rather than one in a velvet gown. Mm-hmm. The actual possible origins are, some theories are that it's got Tudor origins with the dissolution of the monasteries.
Okay.
Because that created a lot more beggars, and some of them would be very finely dressed beggars, because until very recently they were in positions of power, and like abbots tended to be very well dressed. Like monastic things were basically huge businesses until they were all ripped down.
Yeah.
Another theory is that it's got something to do with the Glorious Revolution of 1688, when William of Orange took the throne.
Okay.
There's a similar rhyme from a handwritten text found. The text was written in 1672. Hark, hark, the dogs do bark, my wife is coming in. With rogues and jades and roaring blades, they make a devilish din.
Gosh.
So there's some theories that maybe it is older than the Glorious Revolution of 1688, and that was a parody of Hark, Hark, the Dogs Do Bark.
Okay.
One of the things that kind of fights against it being the Glorious Revolution is that the opening line of The Tempest, written by Mr. Shakespeare in around 1610, is Hark, Hark, the Watchdogs Bark.
Mm-hmm.
So as that may be either that inspired the nursery rhyme, or that was a reference to an old rhyme.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds likely that just bits and pieces got used and reused in various rhymes, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's quite satisfying to hark, hark, the dogs do bark. It works.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that so many old nursery rhymes and rhymes that we just sort of know or linger around in the back of our brains tend to have weirdly militaristic origins.
Yeah, or certainly theorised thus.
Yes.
Sometimes I wonder if nursery rhyme folklorists are just keeping themselves in business and the words sounded fun and caught on.
Quite possibly, but I still want to go into nursery rhyme folklore.
Razor and all that, but yes.
Simple things.
Well, it's like everyone going on about the Ring-a-Ring-a-Rosies being the plague, and it turned out not to be, didn't it?
Yeah. So, Colin and Cuddy police reports are entertaining.
Yes, they are. Sergeant Colon's I like because he's clearly got the idea of what he should be doing here, but can't help put his own little asides in. So he goes, whereupon we conversed with Clown Boffo, who said Clown Bino, who the corpus derelicti, was definitely sin the day before, just after the explosion. brackets. This is dead bent, in my opinion. The reason being, the stiff was dead at least 2 days. Nobs agrees. So someone's telling meat pies, never trust anyone who falls on his ass for a living. Whereupon Dr. Whiteface messes. And then, of course, we have Sergeant, not Sergeant, I'm very sorry, I'm giving him a promotion, Private Cuddy's, Lance Constable Cuddy, it's right here, who writes in runic style and
is very used to sagas.
Yes, and the saga kind of ode style.
I do like Bright Was the Morning and High Our Hearts when we proceeded to the Alchemist Guild, where events event fated, as I shall now sing.
Yes. I shall clearly just learned by rote the correct way to start a passage and just stuck with it, no matter the accuracy or lack thereof.
I shall deliver this report in the style of Beowulf.
Yes. Yeah. And then I thought the other little bit I like is just a couple of bits reminiscent of good crime novels, with tiny bits of foreshadowing and tension building. And
yes.
So a nice example being page 178, where Vimes is basically just sitting there thinking. And if you can write that well, you're a good writer. But his thought process kind of goes, and once again, Vimes felt the edge of something, some fundamental central thing. And it's a good bit of foreshadowing, B, a good way of describing your kind of mind being on the precipice of a realization. And I don't have C, but again, the rule of threes is irresistible.
I feel like we need to just have, we really like the rule of three as our automatic C for everything.
Yeah. On one hand, two, and C.
On the one hand, on the other hand, on my left foot.
Yes, there's little bits. Do we have big things? Do we have big things we liked?
I think we've actually got a couple
Could there be things we want to talk about, for instance, in talking points? Oh, yes, you've listed them here.
I have, handily, in this episode.
Here with him, I shall sing them.
High are our hearts, and not so bright is the evening as we proceed along the eventated event.
Mildly gloomy is the evening as we proceeded to the third page of the show notes, the events of which herein I shall sing.
So we start by singing about literary devices.
Oh, that's me. Sorry. Yeah.
People as things.
Yeah, just another one of Pratchett's nice little threads through the book you can notice here. I think he's making a habit of making subtle parallels between people and objects he's describing. So the two I thought particularly are of note was Vimes being described indirectly as a spring when Leonard of Quirm is talking about how you can wind up a spring and hope it doesn't break. And then Vetinari gets the kind of realization that, may have broken that spring. What is Vimes?
Yes, he didn't punch the wall.
Yes. And also to Quirm related, because Leonard is frankly a well of interesting literary devices. Mm. Leonard de Quirm is hidden away somewhere safe, but not gotten rid of out of fascination in much the same way the Gon was.
Yeah,
that's another subtle-ish, obvious-ish parallel drawn.
There's something of Leonard being the loaded Gon as well. Everything he does has the potential to be very dangerous.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. My little headcanon, by the way, is that Leonard of Quirm was briefly apprenticed to Bloody Stupid Johnson, and I don't care if the timelines don't match up. I like it.
I like it. Let's go with that.
Oh. So, yeah, that is not really a very long talking point, but
it's something clever that's in here, yeah.
Yeah, and it's another example of just why it feels so satisfying to read Pratchett books, is that when you start picking at it like this, you can kind of start finding the reasons as to why they just feel so good reading them. You just, even if you're subconsciously making the connections, you are making these little connections, and human mind loves making connections, and he's doing it for you, and it's very clever.
I really enjoy it.
Well done.
Speaking of Pratchett and clever writing.
Yeah. Yes, Joanna, that is the podcast. Good segue.
Sorry. Okay, but going into his couples and dialogues, this is something I really wanted to talk about. There's lots of really good pairings in this section.
Yeah.
And it's something I really enjoy. It's as a writing device and something that particularly works in the middle section of the book. Everyone pairs off and goes and does their own thing. So you have Carrot and Angua going off to tour the city. You have Cuddy and Detritus going off to the Alchemist Guild and then patrolling together. You have Colin and Nobbs and their sort of constant pairing and banter. and lots of other little moments as well, especially with Vetinari. And it's something I love in general, but to go into the specifics of some of the couples and why I love them, especially Carrot and Angua, Pratchett doesn't do a lot of romance, and that's fine. These books don't need a lot of romance, but I think the very slow burn C plot of Carrot and Angua is a lovely one because it's written as such a slow burn, and it's not, it at no point gets in the way of the plot.
Yeah, I quite like that it's a two-way street as well. It's not just Carrot being unrequited. It's not just Angua just falling head over heels for him. There's resistance from both sides at various points, and there's
resistance at both on both sides.
It's a lot more realistic.
Yeah, they're also not unaware of each other's attraction, if that makes sense. Carrot is obviously trying to court Angua. In fact, there's a really lovely moment, and it's one of, this was nearly my quote because of
you're a simp.
Because I'm a simp. This is one of my favourite Discord
moments. Me too, I fucking love it. I love it.
She vaguely suspected that Carrot was trying to court her, but instead of the usual flowers or chocolate, he seemed to be trying to gift wrap a city. It's just such a Carrot thing. He loves this city. He's made his home here. He walks through it like a tiger walking through a jungle, like she clocks in the earlier section. And
there's a little heart next to it. The note on it, on my thing. There's a little heart next to that and a little heart next to when Cuddy's teaching to try to set a count.
Yes, these are both heart-worthy moments. But yeah, they don't just gel together. They don't immediately fall in love, but they also don't have the irritating thing.
Yeah.
And it is a background.
A deliberate misunderstanding, like, ooh.
The way it's a background to them as police people works because they both have to put their jobs over everything else they do so much, and not just in the section but throughout the book. And like, mild spoiler, they often have to put their jobs above everything else in the other books. It's what the Watch do. And it's that whole theme of their watchmen first and dwarves or trolls or werewolves or women second.
And this is Angua's first go at this, I guess, as well, whereas Carrot already kind of knows it.
And you
first, I guess
you also have the way they play off each other. They don't gel perfectly, but not in a life-ending way. You know, Carrot has his prejudice against the undead, which includes Angua as a werewolf, and she knows that, but he doesn't. You have the moment with their name, with the list of names in Vimes's room when Vimes is unconscious.
That's one of those moments that I could almost quote verbatim from the book, despite not having read it for years.
It's one of my favourite moments in this entire book. That moment where Angua leaps to an assumption, which, to be fair, she has not got to know Vimes. She may... I'm not saying Vimes comes off like he is the sort of dude who would pay lots of women for whatever she thinks he's paying women for. But she is a woman who has only met him as this very grumpy boss in the background. Needlework.
Exactly.
That's the sort of assumption that she's making. And Carrot's coldness, where he really feels the need to defend exactly what Vimes is doing. And I don't think it's that he would be appalled at the sort of person he would pay for, say, seamstress services. But that he obviously holds Vimes in such high regard that he really wants her to not jump to a conclusion of exactly what he's doing. And there's that Angua's realisation as Carrot sort of very politely organising a militia of, he could lead armies if he wanted to. And obviously other people have seen this regalness in Carrot. That's the plot of the book, is that Carrot should be king. But she's the first one who sees it and gets that that's not what he wants, and considers that as important, that that's not what he wants. And then, like, the other big buddy, obviously you've got Colin and Nobbs, who have this ongoing banter from guards. They're great. And you have Cuddy and Detritus, and they're...
bromance.
Their bromance, their buddy cop thing. It's very...
They went so quickly from hatred to love.
Yeah, it's the opposites attract buddy cop thing, the sort of the bonding over counting together. But I think the moment that really, really got me is when Detritus has been rescued from the Pork Futures warehouse and Cuddy is standing up for him, and he looks at Detritus and realises all of the bullet holes on Detritus were at Cuddy's head height.
Yeah.
And it's that, fuck, he did fucking save my life there.
And it's nice that that realisation wasn't what changed his mind, actually. He got to know Detritus and that changed his mind.
Yeah.
So, like, they were already friends, like, because the cliche thing to do would be for Cuddy to change his mind after Detritus had saved Cuddy's life.
But Cuddy was trying to save Detritus's life before we realized that Detritus had really, really saved his.
Yeah.
So it cements it rather than being what starts it.
Yeah.
And the other, before I sort of go into my closing statement, you know, the other sort of moments of couples, or not couples, but dialogues that I really like, you've got Vimes and Sham Haga and their banter.
Mm.
And Vimes is trying to order a cup of coffee as black as a moonless night.
Yeah.
And in doing some reading around this, apparently there were tons of Twin Peaks references that I missed, because I guess this is probably around the height of Twin Peaks, but I've never seen it. But it is also, it's very trad cop stuff, the coffee and donuts.
Okay.
And I like the scene between Vimes and Sham, where Vimes really just wants something that will set him on the level, and Sham is insisting.
Vimes was a little unfair.
He was a little unfair.
He was the one who went into the stupid metaphors, like insulting Sham's breakfast and going on about the moonlit coffee. And then it was like, and a donut! No nonsense! It's like, it was your nonsense, Vimes.
You started. I mean, if someone came to me and started this nonsense, I would have responded with Sham's nonsense. I have a lot of respect for Sham in that moment.
Yes, agree.
And then also Vetinari, in his scenes with Vimes and his scenes with Leonard, Vetinari plays off best when it's him and one other character, just like it was Dr. Kreese's.
Yeah, he does need a, it's not even a foil, is it? Just somebody to bounce his ideas off.
Yeah. He's a bit like, there's a term in tech stuff, a rubber duck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, if you were stuck on a problem, you sit and explain what you're trying to do to, say, a rubber duck on your desk, and you'll generally solve the problem by doing
Leonard of Quirm is a hell of a rubber duck.
If there was ever a rubber duck.
Very clever rubber duck.
And that's what Vetinari does when he's got Vimes in front of him. And, you know, he's trying to manipulate Vimes into solve everything, and he works out he's pushed him too far.
Yeah.
But I like these small scenes of two people in rooms. It was, to go briefly a bit tangenty, but it was why the early seasons of... I know, it's so unlike me. The early seasons of Game of Thrones.
Oh my God. Yeah, were
I really love the early seasons of the TV show up through season 4. A, because it was sticking a bit more to what was going on in the books, so it was better writing. And B, because they had fuck all budget. So 90% of the scenes were two people being dramatic with each other in a room.
Yes.
And that was what the show always did best. One of the best moments in it is a 10-minute monologue from Jamie Lannister when he's had his arm cut off and he's in a bath.
Well, you know, that's basically what was behind the success of Blackadder as well. The first season of that wasn't particularly successful, and it was high budget, too fancy nonsense. Season 2, budget was massively slashed. That brought Ben Elton on for some good dialogue.
So what improved Blackadder was swapping the dynamic between Blackadder and Baldrick. In season 1, Blackadder's the dumb one, Baldrick's quite clever.
Yeah.
And when it was swapped, it was a lot better because Tony Robinson is brilliant.
Yes.
I've also got a soft spot for him because I used to love Time Team. Anyway, back to Game of Thrones.
Oh, I want to watch all episodes of Time Team.
I think there's some on YouTube.
Okay, sweet.
So back to Game of Thrones to make my way back around to Pratchett.
Sure.
What I like about the situation is it is quite often just two people having a conversation. Sometimes while action is taking place, you know, Cuddy and Detritus are walking as they're counting together, and then they're on the run and they're going through the tunnels.
Yeah.
Carrot and Angua are walking around the city.
Yeah.
Vimes is being dragged from place to place and person to person.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes down to two people figuring things out together and bouncing off each other to get to a final point. And it's...
Yeah.
I wish I could adapt very specifically this book for TV, not talking about the watch TV adaptation that exists. But the point is, if I was going to adapt these books for TV, I would have so much fun adapting this book and these scenes into a screen thing.
Yeah, because almost all of the narrative is done via dialogue, rather than a he realised, which is very hard to...
adapt. No, these are really, really solid two-handers. And if you can imagine a series of cutting between... Vimes and Vetinari to Carrot and Angua to Colan and Nobbs to Cuddy and Detritus, and just wrote and moving Vimes from Vetinari to Carrot to Cuddy and Detritus to Colan and Nobbs as Vetinari goes through Leonard of Quirm.
Can I just say that at the very moment you said a very solid two-handers, I looked down and saw my note about the knocker's knocker. So, which I didn't include in the podcast, but until right now.
I think on that, though, that's all I've got to say about dialogues, because I've got nowhere to go from the knocker's knocker.
I'm sorry.
Please don't explain that to me. I want to leave that as a mystery on the podcast.
What? Okay.
The, whatever the knocker's knocker is. I don't
okay,
want to
sure,
know.
Okay, sure, sure, sure. Yeah, okay.
I'm enjoying the mystery now.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, so I put down, again, it's pretty short talking point just because the actual talking points we have are quite serious ones. But the counting system I found pretty interesting when Cuddy's
one too many lots.
One too many lots. So Cuddy's teaching detritus to count, and then detritus is kind of running with it and finding his own methods. So trolls, I would say in this, are described with a lot of parallels to computers, so they need to be kept cold to work properly, as a server does. If any IT person will tell you, you need a very chilly room to keep one's server, lest it overheat catastrophically. And detritus, when he does start counting, does so in multiples of two, which is a base two or a binary system, which is what we use on computers in one form or a complicated another.
And he is silicon-based.
Yeah, he is silicon-based, exactly. And silicon chips, as we all know, are what make computers go brrr.
Our intense tech knowledge really coming to the fore.
Base 8 or base 16 are kind of what computers are run on now. And base 8, so just briefly, base means like what the number system goes from. So we use base 10, which is metric. But base 8 gives me a headache. And Tom Lehrer agrees and did a whole funny song about new maths, which I think, I don't know if they still do. I think it must have been very brief. Apparently British school children were, no, American school children, Tom Lehrer, American, isn't he, were encouraged to learn some mathematics new math via base 8, which sounds absolutely ridiculous. So I'm going to link to that video because it's funny.
It is brilliant.
Some ancient civilizations used base 60. Which in theory, because it's a very good number, which is the technical term, that can be divided by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 12, 15, 20, 30, and of course 60. Which is quite good.
Is that why we now use it for minutes and hours and things?
I think so. And then I thought, one too many lots, that's interesting. I wonder if anyone actually counts like that, or translated version of that. Because trolls in Discworld go up to two, and then from there,
many and lots.
And I think, I'm not sure if it's in this book later or if it's in another book, you can see that sometimes they go many, many lots or something like that. Or two lots or something. But it might refer to the idea of cultures that had or have words only for one and two. And it's a bit of a controversial subject, so I'll tread lightly, but Wolpiri language, which is spoken by the Australian Aboriginal tribe, which is Wolpiri, has words for one, two, many, and few, rather than many and lots. But that's a very simplified way of putting it, and there are ways to convey different amounts, as I think Pratchett tries to put across that there are in Trollish. They just don't match up with ours as an easy translation. But then something that happened after this book was published, but is connected enough that I thought was worth mention, is Toki Pona, which is a philosophical, artistic, constructed language. And if you've heard anything wankier than that this week, I'd love to hear it. which is made by Sonia Lang, a Canadian artist and philosopher, I think. But it's like a deliberately simple language to encourage focused thinking without going around the point and tangenting. So it'd be like our worst enemy. But
I've never wanted anything less.
But numerically, it's very simple by design, and it only has words for one and two. You can thus express different numbers by combining those two words, but it gets into difficulty quickly, and that's on purpose, so that you don't talk about maths, I guess. I thought that was quite interesting.
We don't mention the maths.
Exactly so. Yes. I'm not sure if I'm going to link many sources to this because it's either boring or controversial, but interested listeners can listen to Tom Lehrer and then do their own fun research into base 16.
All of our listeners should just go and listen to some Tom Lehrer, to be perfectly honest. I love him so much.
It's a nice palate cleanser between literally any activity.
After every activity. I haven't listened to that since Spring Sprung. On to the less fun, which is a big final talking point.
This was a terrible segue, I'm sorry.
we can't really avoid discussing this when we're talking about this book, but Crime, Punishment and Bad Policing, which is a very low controversy topic in comparison. There are obviously...
Need to be careful with this one.
No, not at all. There are obviously lots of examples of really bad policing in this book. You have Cuddy and Detritus giving chase, and their logic is this person must be guilty because he's running away from the cops.
Yeah.
Which in itself, not great, but it does make sense within the confines of this book and the way the watch is set up.
Yes, but as a policing attitude, terrible, and leads to innocent people being shot.
Yes, very much so. And within that, there's also that section. Cuddy had only been a guard for a few days, but he'd already absorbed one important and basic fact. It's almost impossible for anyone to be in a street without breaking the law. There are crimes such as obstruction to lingering while being the wrong colour, shape, / species, / sex. Which
is a little bit more direct.
Bit close to home there.
How much of awareness do you think?
I mean, it's the 90s. It's not exactly ancient history. I think there would have been awareness. I don't think the awareness that we have today of corrupt policing.
Yeah, I mean, specifically how much awareness of the fact that he was describing something gross do you think Pratchett had in this?
I think it's really difficult because I think these things were enough in the public awareness that it was cliche that that's how police act.
Yeah.
To the point where it could be used as a joke and readers would recognize it.
Yeah.
I don't think tackling how serious that was is completely at the forefront of his mind, but I don't think it completely isn't. You know, the whole point of the Day Watch and Captain Quirk is that they are, in effect, kind of the bad guys of this section, and one of the ways in which they are is that they just assume a troll is guilty.
Just arrest a random troll.
Yeah, he's a troll. He must be guilty of something. So he puts the unsympathetic characters into the position of being the bad cops.
Yeah.
But he doesn't stop the sympathetic characters like Cuddy from also being that way. And I think it's kind of something you'll see develop in the writing as we go through more of the Watch books, where he managed to put more of a firm line between good and bad policing.
Yes, yeah.
But I don't think he's quite there yet. And I think if the option was between making Cuddy a good cop and not having this joke in, he went with having the joke in, whereas in a later Discworld book, he might not do the joke because it would make the character a bad cop.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's an unfortunate tendency in the general cops and robber genre to give your favoured character carte blanche to do whatever because, ends means that old chestnut.
Yeah, it's something I binged all of Brooklyn Nine-Nine recently.
Good because of it.
But using like another police comedy thing, I rewatched all of Brooklyn Nine-Nine recently, and I think in later seasons it gets very good at dealing with what modern policing is.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
But in the early seasons, there's lots of jokes about characters beating up people to get confessions, especially Diaz, because she's the big scary one, which obviously means she's my type. She really looks like she could kill me with a sword and I'm into it. But I think the show got better at kind of not making jokes about police brutality because they were too real.
Yeah.
And I think the books do in the same way. I think they start taking what is good versus bad policing more seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting to keep an eye on for sure during the Watch arc.
Yeah, there's another footnote moment. The axiom, honest men have nothing to fear from the police, is currently under review by the Axioms Appeal Board. So, he's acknowledging that
it is bullshit.
That policing is corrupt. But I think he wants his characters to not be corrupt, but kind of forgets to make them uncorrupt every now and then.
Yeah.
And some of that is Cuddy is a newbie cop, and so he's mostly learned from Colin.
Yeah.
Who is a bit old school, and Colin is one of...
Yeah, that's another one of those weasel words, isn't it? I'm sure that's exactly the right word to use here for the old school rather than shit.
But Colin learns. That's the point. Yeah. He does learn and grow. So does Nobby.
Not all the way, I'm going to say, but yeah.
Not all the way, but he definitely gets quite a lot better.
Those two are like deliberately flawed characters, even as a... Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, right now he's getting better. The fact that in the last, like, and it's acknowledged that he is, that a few months ago he would have just gone, oh well.
Yeah. Whereas now he does care. And I think all of the watch rally round Cuddy Detritus and what happens in the next section, where we end up with a lot more dwarf and troll recruits, they will very much rally round the watchman first, species second thing. Yeah. Which is, and they rally around Coldface being arrested unjustly.
Yeah.
Because what happens to Coldface is basically racial profiling.
Yeah. The thing, what do you think of the Watchman first, species second thing, though? Because that seems like a parallel to another problematic thing, which is saying, oh, the policemen are your family and you should protect, they are your brothers, you protect them above all other.
I don't think it's used problematically in this book the way it is used problematically in real life.
Yeah.
And again, I think if these books were being written for the first time now, I think this would be a very different... I think it would be the same story, but I think it would be told differently, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
But I'm not going to sit and say, oh, it's the early 90s, it was a different time, partly because that makes me feel really old, because God damn it, the 90s were 10 years ago. But I think there was less of a cultural awareness than we have now, just... Back of social media.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I can try and climb up top a high horse, but frankly, 2 years ago, I wasn't a third as aware of various police brutality stuff as I am now.
I've never really picked up on the bad policing aspects of these books in the past, apart from the very obviously telegraphed stuff with the Day Watch, where it's pointing at them going, look, these are the bad guys, these are the bad cops.
Neon
Look
lights,
at them being bad.
Oh no, eggy.
Even though our Night Watch are doing a lot of the same thing. And that's even likely, without going into knobby rubbing corpses on a battlefield. But
well, no, do you know what? I feel like that's nowhere near as bad as the other stuff.
I've got nothing against knobby rubbing corpses. He can do what he likes. Oh. But yeah, I don't really have anywhere further to go on that.
No, I think it was worth acknowledging and definitely an interesting starting point for something that's going to be a running theme through the rest of the Watch books. So,
yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing how Pratchett writing about police work develops as we keep going through the Watch books.
Yeah. Yes. Agreed.
Have you got an obscure reference for Neil?
Yeah, so Joanna, the sewers. As I said, I'd get back to them, and so I do.
Mm.
The Via Cloaca. Now, this is a sewer under Dankmore Porks that's been built upon and forgotten, and it's from grander days when architects did things like have proper sewers instead of throwing poo out the window. forgot the word for that there. Waste out the window. which is a little bit of a parallel to old empires being built over during the Dark Ages and things, I think. Now, Annotator Pratchett has this down as a reference to the Cloaca Maxima, which is Rome's impressive sewer system.
Mm.
But I reckon that's not right. I reckon it's more based on the Roman sewers under York.
Yeah.
Reason being, the Cloaca Maxima is actually still used, isn't forgotten at all. But as you probably know, my darling, York was first Iboricum, founded by Romans in 71 AD.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 70s, the 70s, not 71 AD, 1971, yeah. some 70s later, sorry, base 70s. In 1972, in fact, a contractor building on York's Church Street found a network of tunnels below the ground, and the tunnels formed part of an extensive Roman sewage network built thousands of years ago. And archaeologists discovered like gaming counters, beads and coins all dating from that time. So I reckon that's what Pratchett's referencing rather than the big Roman one.
Well, Pratchett has mentioned referencing or being inspired by York before. If any of our listeners are in York or have had a chance to go, there's a street called the Shambles, which is widely recognised to be one of the oldest streets in the country. And I believe I remember reading an interview somewhere where he mentioned taking that as a bit of an inspiration for Ankh-Morpork.
Cool. All right. Yeah. All right. Extra confident in my correcting one of my favourite resources.
I think at that point we probably have a million more things we could say, but I really want to order pizza.
Yeah, no, I'm hungry. You going for pizza, not Chinese now?
Yeah, on the basis that I can get pizza delivered, but the only good Chinese is that I can order online is literally below my flat, so I'd have to go collect it because I feel bad getting them.
Can't you order Golden House? Oh, you have to call for Golden House.
Yeah, I'm not talking.
Are you feeling a little bit millennial about the whole?
I'm feeling very millennial. I want to do something on an app and then food is here.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Yeah. Anyway.
Outro us.
Outro
play
us.
Play us, Maestro.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Tree Show Make You Fret. We'll be back next week on Monday. The final part of the discussion. We will be back next Monday. Sorry, it's very late for us, dear listeners. It's past my bedtime. With part three of Men at Arms, which begins on page 249 in the Call You paperback edition, with the bulk of the armory loomed against the sunset.
Ooh, what a nice little descriptive opening.
Yes, and we're going from there to the end, obviously.
Obviously. Why did you even ask? What the hell, guys?
In the meantime, dear listener, you can follow us on Instagram at The Tree Show Make You Fret, on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod. You can find us on Facebook at The Tree Show Make You Fret. You can join our subreddit community, r/TTSMYF.
There are dozens of us.
There are many of us. You can email us your thoughts, queries, castle snacks, and albatross pods, The Tree Show Make You Fret Pod at gmail.com. And if you want to support us financially, then you can go to patreon.com/thetreeshallmakeyoufret. You can exchange your hard-earned pennies for all sorts of fun, bonus nonsense. And thank you very much to everyone who has signed up in our first week. We're very excited. And in the meantime, dear listener,
don't let us detain you. I like that we go, there's always loincloths heavily implied, in the same way that we now go, like, social distanced, of course.
Yes.
Loincloths implied, of course.